Welcome to another edition of the two top. Ladies and gentlemen, friends and rivals, my name is Jared, and with me is my artistic friend, Anna.
Hello.
We will be your hosts for the podcast. We are honored and grateful that you have joined us here at our table. Here at the Game Table Podcast, we take a look at various board, card, and other tabletop games. We give an overview, provide a little insight on how to play, and share some of our thoughts, all in an attempt to give you an idea of how well it would fit for you. Your table. Today, we will be looking at Sagrada, designed by Adrian Adamescu and Daryl Andrews. Artwork created by Peter. You gotta be kidding me.
You've never said the name of an artwork person correctly.
Not with you. Artwork created by Peter Woken and published by Floodgate Games.
Sagrada is a dice drafting window stained glass building game.
Say that five times fast.
You need to savor it because it is so just this powerful game in which players use various colored dice to build out a grid forming different stained glass window art. Tools and hidden goals assist in making sure that your artwork stands out among the rest. Is this game a masterpiece or simply a pile of broken glass? Find out as we discuss Sagrada.
All right, Anna.
Yes, Jared.
Whether it be kindergarten, high school, doodling in your free time.
All the time.
Pretty much everyone has done some form of art. Do you have a memorable piece of art that you created?
I do indeed. Did you know at one point in time I wanted to be an artist?
No, I didn't know that.
Well, yes, I did. At one point in time, early on in my wee life, I wanted to be an artist. Both of my grandmothers are artists. And so I think
How old were you when this dream was in your brain?
It was a good bit. It was probably until... I don't know, probably until middle school or so when I realized that I liked people better than art and then I decided I wanted to do something with people instead.
That makes sense.
But yeah, it was for a good little bit. So okay. I did all sorts of artwork and I still enjoyed taking art classes in high school and exploring. It was like a good outlet for me still. So you said memorable piece of art?
Yeah, anything that either that you currently have or that you used to have or something you made or, you know, whatever. It's a very open-ended question. Here on the podcast, we just want to know a little bit more about you.
Well, there was this one piece of art, Jared.
Just one.
I was very, very proud of it. I was supposed to, I think it was for like a freshman art one class or something. I was supposed to make like a surreal landscape. And so I made an image of an ocean and there were all of these islands in the ocean and there were animals in the ocean and the islands all had rock formations that were different hands that were making different gestures coming up out of the rock formations. And then around the ocean, you see there's actually this huge pair of hands that's actually holding this entire world. And then it was black all around. And I was so proud of it. I thought it was like the coolest thing I'd ever created. And so I was taking it home and I left it in the locker room during PE class. And when I came back, somebody had ripped it up.
Oh my.
Yep. It was a very sad day.
That is... So I'll just take a moment of silence for our loss.
Yeah, for my favorite surreal landscape that somebody was obviously incredibly jealous of and ripped up during PE. Anyway, what's your favorite piece of artwork that you've ever created, Jared?
So it dawned on me as I was about to say this. The irony of this statement as I create a form of art in podcast form. goodness gracious, it's going to be an episode.
Jared,
can't even
you
say.
You don't need to say that about your artwork.
Can't even say things right. This is not boding. Well, this, that, you know what? Scratch the irony. I am not an artist in almost any form or fashion. I do dabble in woodworking, and that comes out okay sometimes. But I am just, you know, I'm just kind of a big brutish kind of person. I don't have the delicacies or the intricate skills to be an artist in a lot of ways. And so I very much appreciate artists because I very much live in hobbies that really, if you are an artist, you can really thrive in, whether it be, you know, podcasting or D&D or whatever it may be. Like, I would say that.
Are you saying that you like to comment on other people's art?
Yeah, I also like it when they create art for the things that we're involved in.
You like to facilitate an art platform.
Yeah, I like to create the opportunity and then let an artist take it.
Wow, what a good pairing there is between the two of us.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe my artistry is creating the opportunity. I don't know. Anyways, so I have a lot of like really bad art that I've done over the years. One in particular, when I was at a summer camp when I was like, I don't know, 9 or something. And we had to do that. One of the things that we had to do was this leather art project where you weren't really making leather. You were more like just cutting out leather and then putting stamps and stuff on it and that sort of thing. Well, I made one for my dad, and I truthfully did not expect him to keep this or, you know, whatever, but he put it on his keychain and kept it for the rest of his life, which, I mean, thankfully was another 24 years after that, 25 years after that, so I was... It blew me away that he would hold on to that. And so I will always cherish that memory. And it's kind of crazy because that piece of artwork came back to me because after Dad passed, I inherited his truck, which still had the piece of artwork on it. So it's nothing special. It's just a little piece of leather that has some stars stamped into it and it says Dad on it. And that's something that always has been very near and dear to me.
You know, I feel like the listeners of these two top episodes just get a real glimpse into the depths of our heart whenever we share these opening questions.
Yeah, this is like my therapy. So I appreciate it, listeners, that all of you are
really
here
nice
to let me work through some stuff. Well, today, like I said, we are going to be talking about the game Sagrada. I am blown away when I looked it up that this game is already 7 years old because I remember us sitting down together to play this game for the first time.
About 7 years ago.
Yeah, about 7 years ago. And just really being blown away by how good of a game this is. And it was really well designed. You know, once people got past the initial shock of the complexity of putting this little puzzle together, flows really well. It does a lot of really good things, so I'm excited to talk about it today. So first, Anna, I think we will take a moment and talk about how to play this game.
Yes, that's a good idea.
All right, so in Sagrada, you are building a stained glass window, and you are trying to do it better than everybody else at the table, who also has their own stained glass window. The goal of the game is to have the most points, and there's a variety of ways to score those points. So you'll be given what looks like a stained glass holder where you have a slot at the bottom where you can slide in a card. You'll be dealt a couple of different double-sided cards. They essentially have different designs and puzzles that you're working through to try and create your masterpiece. And what I mean by that is it's not just a grid of 5x4 and they're all blank spaces. You slide the card into the grid, it creates that 5x4. But different cards will have different requirements. So you might have a space that requires a purple die or a space that specifically requires a 6 of any color, things like that. Or some of them are blank spaces. And there's different levels of difficulty amongst the cards. And there's a good stack of cards there. And what they will do is they will compensate your difficulty by giving you more tokens that you can use on various tools during the game, and we'll get to that in a minute. So you decide which of the cards that you want to use. You discard the other one, and then you slide that into your player board, and then you collect the number of tokens that's on the bottom of the card, and then you are pretty much ready to go. In the middle of the table, there is a board that will hold the dice that are not drafted during the game. There will be various tools that will let you break the rules of the game by spending the favor tokens that you were given at the beginning of the game. And there will also be public scoring goals. That might be for every set of one and twos that you have on the board at the end of the game, you'll get 2 points each. Or it might be for each set of five colors, you'll get 4 points. Or if you have all unique dice numbers in a column, you'll get 4 points per column. Things of that nature. You will also be given a private objective. Essentially, you're going to be dealt a card that has a die color on it. In the game, there are five different colors: purple, yellow, green, blue, and red. You'll be dealt a private goal. It will have a die color on it. The goal for you at that point is to collect as many of that color as you can, because at the end of the game, the sum of all of that color on your board is going to be the additional points that you get. At the beginning of the round, players will pull a number of dice out of the bag equal to the number of players times 2 plus 1. So in a 4-player game, you're pulling out 9 dice total. As you do different rounds, you'll take turns being the first player. So you'll roll the dice that are pulled out, and then the first player picks one die and adds it to their board. And then the next player goes, and then you get to the last player if you're in a 4-player game. Then the draft snakes back. So if Anna's the fourth player, she's going to get to pick 2 dice. And then the third player gets to pick again. Second player gets to pick again. And then finally, the first player who got to pick the first die gets to pick between the last two. The last die is added to the main board in the middle. The reason for that is there's certain power-up cards that will allow you to pull dice from the middle, swap it out with dice that you have already used. Play will continue like this until 10 rounds have been completed. At the end of the 10th round, you will count up your points and determine who has won the game. Again, you'll score points for completed public objectives, completing private objectives. Each favor token that you did not spend will give you 1 victory point, and you lose 1 point for each open space on your window. Sometimes you won't have the ability to play some of the dice that you draft. The reason for that, again, your card will have specific requirements. You can only play certain colors on certain spots on the board, only play certain numbers on certain parts of the board. And if that wasn't enough, you cannot place the same color or the same number next to each other orthogonally. So up, down, left, or right. That's pretty much the game. We'll get back over to the table and discuss. All right, Anna Sagrada.
Yeah.
What do you like about this game? Because I know that you like it, and this was one of those games where when we looked across the table after playing it for the first time, we both knew that we wanted this game.
100%. Yes. I'm trying to remember if I played it with you for the first time or if I, were you there?
Yeah, we played.
And it was with Adam.
With Adam and one other guy.
Yeah, and another guy at like one of the Nashville tabletop days.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. That's what I thought. I only remembered Adam, not you. Sorry.
Dang. Ahem. That's a,
Ahem. But anyway, well, because I thought I had played it before and I was like, man, babe, you have to try this game. And then you played it with me the second time. That's what I was remembering. But I have to say, from just looking at the game itself and pulling out the components, I was excited from the start because it is gorgeous. It really is. Pretty. On the front, it's like this exploding starburst of stained glass, and all of the game boards are beautiful stained glass arrangements. You could really just kind of look at your game board for a while and be content without even playing the game for a little while. And then as you go through, you get to create your own stained glass.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. And it kind of feels like a puzzle going through it, too. Because you've got certain parameters for arranging your board, but then you've got to change your strategy as you go through based on what dice are coming up. And so that was kind of a fun aspect of it too, is it felt like you're kind of completing a puzzle as you went through it.
I agree. The artwork in this game is fantastic, as it needed to be given what it is trying to emulate. I really enjoy that you get a full stained glass holder as your player board. It, within that holder, it creates the board for you. And I appreciate that because with games where you're placing in specific spots, it's very easy to choose not to have a holder and instead just place it on top of a mat. And it's very easy for like a table to get bumped and then stuff goes everywhere or whatever. But because this is inset, the dice sit in there really nice and stay locked in, which is very important because of how thinky this puzzle can be. And you're, you know, constantly trying to figure out how to navigate some of the dice not tripping over each other, I guess, for lack of a better word. But yes, yeah, the artwork is really nice. I love the translucent nature of the dice themselves. Definitely a solid choice for adding to that look of the windowed tint. So definitely did a great job with the artwork for sure. I really enjoy drafting that push and pull of I need to take this one and I want that one, but is that one going to be there when it gets back to me? And it's a different kind of player interaction where you are both interacting with the other players and doing your own thing at the same time.
Oh yeah, 100%. Because usually if you've got a whole pool of dice, there's a couple that will work. And so you want to pick based on what you think the other people aren't going to pick first.
Yeah, I feel like in this game particularly, there's times where I have left the best play on the table for me because I thought that had a better chance of making it back around.
Yeah, definitely.
So I really appreciate that push and pull.
And I would say there's less player interaction in terms of there's some games where you can see the strategy the other person's going for and you can be like, oh, I'm going to mess them up. I think if you really tried to mess somebody up in this game, you would mess yourself up because it's such a complex puzzle that you're trying to put together. So I think really it's this balance of you could take something that you know you need and they also need, but you couldn't just necessarily go straight up and backstab somebody in the player interaction in this game.
Yeah, I mean, I think I definitely agree with that in a four-player game. I felt like when we play two-player and it's only one other board that you're looking at and you're only pulling five dice instead of nine, you do have a little bit more of a opportunity to say, okay, I'm going to take this because Jared has already taken six red dice and there's nowhere else for him to put red dice. And so because he's only got red dice, he's not going to be able to take anything. So I think there's a little bit of that.
Oh, do you think I did that in this last game?
Yes, I 100% think that you did that twice in this last game.
I don't know about
twice.
That.
Twice.
Maybe I just really didn't need more red dice.
I don't think that was it.
Uh-huh.
I fully believe that you tried to sabotage me.
No, I fully believe that I had to. Just like I said, I had two good plays and I was like, well, I'll do this play first because I know Jared isn't going to take that red dice that I need because he can't put it anywhere.
That's fine. I'm just saying there were multiple times where I looked over and saw you still needed a three and I was like, well, I could take this one or I could take the three and I'd rather take the three so she can't have her spot there.
Whoa, you do that on purpose?
100%.
My goodness gracious.
And I'm not ashamed of it.
I don't stab people in the back. Especially my husband.
Wow. You just remember Adam instead of me.
What? Oh, my goodness.
It's its own form of betrayal. I'm just kidding.
Okay, fine.
All right. But yeah, so no, I really enjoy the drafting. I enjoy the puzzly aspect, like you mentioned. I really like the variety that just comes in this base game. I feel like there is a ton of cards to work with, whether it be the cards that you slide into your player board to act as the board for that game or the various tools. I think it gives a nice variety to where, especially at a family level, you're not ever feeling like you've worn the game out.
Yes, I agree with that. And I think there's a good deal of variety because you've got your own board that you're working with. But really, the only points that your board gives you is not negative points. If you don't fill it up, it gives you negative points, but it doesn't really give you points other than that. And I think that's something that I don't consider as often. I think I more often prioritize getting a complicated board and getting the puzzle all worked out. But really, you've got to really be balancing your own puzzle board with the bonus cards
right.
that you're getting points for. You've got a private bonus card and you've got three public bonus cards that everybody's going for, because you're not actually getting points except for with those bonus cards. And so there's different levels of difficulty with the boards. And so sometimes you might think that a more complicated board gives you the more potential for points, but really a more complicated board just gives you more of the, is it favor tokens? Is that what they're called?
That's right.
It gives you, just gives you more of the favor tokens that you can use for cheats, essentially. So you get a more complicated board. It's, the puzzle's harder, but you've got more opportunities to quote unquote cheat. But on the other hand, a less complex board where you're not having to work so hard to solve the puzzle might give you more opportunities to actually get more points from the point cards, the one private and the three public that y'all have. So I think that's something where I am still exploring. I used to, when I started, always want to take the really complicated one because I wanted the complicated puzzle. But then I played with somebody one time that took the easiest one and just focused on getting all the bonuses the whole time, and they actually ended up beating me.
So I also like, from that perspective of the less complex versus more complex, that it's a nice balancing mechanism for more experienced players versus someone who might not play as much. So if this is a two-player game and you're playing with either a child or a spouse who doesn't game as often but is willing to try it, which I really think this is a good one for that. I think that anyone who likes a puzzle or just putting together, you know, a piece of artwork might actually really enjoy this, even if games aren't necessarily like their primary thing. It's a very easy point of entry, but we'll come back to that in a minute. So there's this balancing act where I could give Faith the easier, less complex board, and I have to pick from the heavier ones. And then that way I can still kind of play without fully holding back. So I think that's a nice feature as well.
Yeah. And we have done that with people. If we've played for a while and we know it's their first game, we'll say, why don't you take the one that's a level 4 difficulty instead at the level 5 difficulty. And so that's been a way that we've helped that. But again, I think even for myself, I go for the more difficult ones, and that's not always the best play in terms of what has the potential to earn you more points.
Yeah, for sure. I think another thing for me is what I was just mentioning a minute ago, which is the ease of entry. This game is super easy to understand, super easy to understand both the scoring and the rules themselves. The thinky part is when you actually get yourself into a bind about halfway through the game. And I think some of that's self-inflicted and some of that is just part of the game. And I never mind having a little bit of thinking added on into my games. And I just think that you can play this with family, with newer gamers, with whoever it may be. And I think that it's a good time. And like I said, because of those easier complexities, it's, again, a very easy point of entry. And with those less complexities, honestly, I don't know that it's even that thinky once you get a hold of the game, because you've got a lot of blank spaces to work with. And so you're kind of just making sure that you don't put yourself in that corner.
Yeah. And there's some basic strategy that you could explain to a kid, like, for example, whatever die you play first, you've got to build around that die. You can't just go randomly in all the different parts of the board. So you could give some people some basic strategy, like fill in the ones that are required first and then fill in the other ones, or put a die in the middle first because then you can build around it. And I mean, I think if you get some people going that it is still puzzly and thinky, but you also only have a limited dice pool to work with. And so you're only considering a limited number of options each time to fit into your puzzle. You don't have to get the whole thing figured out all at once. Like, you've got this changing aspect because you don't know what's going to come up in the draft.
Yeah, for sure.
I will also say that if you've got a brand new player or a child that you're playing with, it might be good to check their placement, because just about every single person, the first time we've played with them, has realized 2/3 of the way through the game that they have placed a die illegally, which meaning they've put either a number next to another number, or a color, or same numbers next to each other, or same colors next to each other orthogonally. And then there's always this really embarrassed, I don't know what
crap
to do, kind of like, oh no, what have I done? And so usually it's their first, technically the rules say you're screwed. That's the exact terminology that the rules use.
No. The technical ruling is that you have to discard the die if you find out that you illegally placed it.
But a lot of times they have no idea when they illegally placed it or where or which die is actually first that they even put down. Yeah. And so we've at some point in time been like, well, can we backtrack it? Can we let them rearrange their board somehow? It just makes it kind of complicated. And so if you've got a child or a new player and you just kind of look over and double check their placement, you can avoid that pitfall that we have run into way more times than we should have.
Yeah.
Playing this game.
So I think it's a pro and a con, right? Especially if you're thinking about it from a kid's perspective of, I like teaching the kids how to plan ahead and think through their moves and not just say, oh, well, I want this right now, so I'm going to take it. But instead, okay, well, if I do this now and I already have a six over here, so now I've got two sixes that are close by, how am I going to navigate that later on if the only thing that pops up is another six? So I like it from that perspective, but I agree. It is inevitable that you will have players say, well, guys, I'm sorry, I screwed up and I don't know what to do now. And you can almost feel like the deflation. And so, yeah. So to me, it's something to be very careful of in this game because it feels inevitable for new players. So just, you know, saying, hey, just remember, and saying that multiple times throughout the game just to make sure players are thinking about it, because there is a few things to think through in this game and you don't want them to get to that deflation point.
Yeah. And I'd say there's a couple. I mean, so the boards have some blank places where you can put whatever you want, and they have some places that are certain colors. So you have to put that color there, or a certain number. You have to put that number there. And so maybe if they put a purple one next to a colored purple space, then that would be a chance to say, oh man, sorry, you now can't put a purple one on that purple space. But I also think if it's an accidental, they put two fours next to each other and they don't realize it until halfway through the game, then you might handle that differently.
That's right. What about some things that you don't really like about this game?
I have to go first with that one, huh?
No, I can go first.
Yeah, you go first. Let me think.
Okay. So we mentioned what seems like an inevitable nature of people accidentally screwing up, and the penalty is either somewhat harsh or you've got to give players a pass, which then feels like it skews the game a little bit. And if that was like a one-off, I feel like I wouldn't mention it. But since it happens so often, I feel like it's worth bringing up. Another thing is the private goals. So they have several expansions for this game, which adds different modules and more cards and things like that. And I think that they do fix this with one of the expansions. But in the base game, you only have the five private goals. So you're getting a color and you're kind of at the mercy of what gets pulled out of the bag. I mean, especially in a two-player game where there's only five dice being pulled each round, you might choose a color, like maybe you choose yellow and you see hardly any yellow dice throughout the game. So then you never even had an opportunity to score from your private bonus, and that can be a significant amount of points. So for me, I wish that there were a couple other, and again, it is fixed in expansions, but I wish for the base game that had been thought through a little bit more.
I will say two slight cons, because really I just love this game and I have since the moment I picked it up. One is, I remember when I first started playing the game and we were playing with a pretty full table, we had four people, it was a little bit difficult to tell the difference between some of the stained glass colors because they make them very stained glassy. The red has all of these oranges and yellows mixed into it, and the orange has red and yellows mixed into it. And so I think I remember I was playing a game and maybe I was red and somebody else was orange, and it was a little bit difficult. Or was it red and yellow?
There's no orange in the base game.
Well, see, that's the confusing part, because I think I'm thinking of yellow as orange. Yeah.
Okay.
Because they're all mixed together. Anyway.
Are you saying when the dice are all mixed together?
No, I'm saying the tokens to mark your points are similar
colors.
Oh,
yes, yes.
That's what I'm saying.
That is true. They can feel that way.
And the boards are similar colors.
I think you're, I'm not saying
anything about the dice.
No, I'm with you now. So you're thinking about the scoring markers, like you said. I think you're thinking through the green and the blue because they're almost identical.
Maybe. And I was thinking, yes, the green and the blue are almost identical. I was thinking that the red and the yellow were similar too, but maybe they're not quite as similar as the green and the blue.
So the only reason I correct that is because the yellow one is a board that comes in one of the expansions.
Oh, so we're using a different board.
Yes.
That base game doesn't have. Okay. Apologies. Anyway, I remember getting started with the game and feeling like it was hard to tell some of the colors apart for the game boards and the token pieces where you mark your points. So that's one thing, but I don't know necessarily that I'd want it to change too much because I like the stained glass multicolored aspect of the pieces in the board so much. The other thing is with the cheat cards. So this is a little bit similar.
Officially, they're referred to as the tools, oh, I think, oh, that you're what? Referring to.
They're the cheat cards. The tool cards also are in a couple of different categories. And so you've got cards that will let you move die. You've got cards that will let you change a die to like greater than, less than, face. And I think you've got one that lets you draft two in a row right then or something like that.
I'm not thinking of that one off the top of my head.
Oh, there's one that lets you pull off of the track, the time track too. Yeah.
I think the one you're thinking of is where you can draft a die, throw it back in the bag, and then draft a new die. You just pull one out of the bag. And you're right. There's also one where you immediately, after your first turn, immediately draft a die. So you would draft two at one time.
Yeah, so you would draft two at one time. Yeah. And so if you're thinking about categories for those tool cards, you've got ones that let you change the number slightly. You've got ones that let you pick a completely different die. And then you've got ones that let you move the die. And the last game that Jared and I played, we had two tool cards that let us move die. And one let us ignore color restrictions and the other let us ignore number restrictions. And I didn't find, so a lot of times you're going to be using things like that more late game because you get yourself in a bind and then whatever. And I didn't find that those were as helpful late game because if I was going to move a die, I needed the die that I drafted to be the one that ignored the number or the color restrictions. But I was the wording on the card specifically said the one die you moved is the one where you've got to ignore color and number restrictions. And so those almost made those two tool cards be not nearly as useful. Or if there had been one that said ignore color restrictions with the drafted die and then a different one that said ignore it with the move die, then they could have balanced each other better. And I don't think any of the ones say that you can move and then the drafted one gets to ignore the restrictions.
I don't believe so.
Which, again, was interesting because like late game, that's all that you would really need. Most people fill in the required squares before. So maybe that was nitpicky, but I remember feeling like that this kind of traps you because you can move it, but then you've got something that has a restriction. And so then you still can't do anything. Did you feel like that? Because you were looking at those move cards quite a lot too.
Yeah. So I will agree with you that the tools can be very situational and you might go a whole game and say, I don't even know why this is out here. It's not helpful at all. And meanwhile, everyone's throwing their favorite tokens at this other tool.
There tends to be a one favorite tool that everybody likes but is more useful in the game, yeah.
I will go back to something that you mentioned that you're working on to get better at this game, in that seeing what tools you have from the beginning can also influence how you decide to play out that game.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of going ahead and filling up the ones that meet your color requirements or your number requirements, you might put that off to a different part of the board that is more flexible and then move it into that space later if you need to.
Yeah.
A potential way of playing devil's advocate to that. But I do agree that there is situational frustration with some of the tools in that sometimes they're just not at all part of the game.
Yeah. And you need to really make sure and read the wording on the tools, because you might read one and be like, okay, that means, okay, this one lets me change the number, this one lets me move a die. But then when you actually need it and you go back, oh, where's that tool that let me change the number?
Right.
They are very specific in their wording.
Mm-hmm.
And so it might not be quite as useful as you thought it was at the start.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. All right. So play interaction. I specifically chose this as a two top because my favorite player count for this is at two players. In the base game, it goes up to four. There's an expansion that lets you go up to six, which I think is fine. I think it's a good group game or a good family game if you want it to be that. I don't have any issue with it there, except that it is a lot of downtime if you get a couple of players that get really locked into analysis paralysis and thinking through their turns. Whereas in a two-player game, it's five dice each round, plug and play. You do have one other person that you're keeping an eye on, but I also, like I said before, think you add a lot of interaction there to where you can really pay attention to what's going on with the other player as opposed to just kind of doing your own thing and dealing with whatever draft consequences that come. So I do really think that whether it's with a spouse or a child or whoever, I think that it really sings at two players and it goes super quick too. I think you can get a game of Sagrada in under 30 minutes if you're playing with just two players and you know what you're doing.
Yes, the game time increases significantly if you've got more than two players, which is an important thing to note. So with a two player, you can easily pull this out even as like a quick intro to, I don't know, a date night, a hangout time or whatever. And it can go quick, 20 minutes, you're in and out and you move on. But if you've got a lot of people, especially people that maybe you're explaining it to or people that get really wrapped up in the puzzle aspect and are staring at the dice for forever, then yeah, you're just twiddling your thumbs. Now, I will say that the dice drafting aspect with more people has more anticipation with it. So I didn't feel like I had to think as hard with just two players when I was drafting my dice, except for when I was trying to not screw you over, but help myself at the end there.
No, I get that. I think it is. I mean, yes, you could take the time to try and figure out what everyone wants to do at six players, but that's just not reasonable for the time that you want this game to take. So there is a much higher chance of what will feel like randomness with a higher player count. And you're kind of like, all right, let's see if it actually makes it back around. But I don't really have any idea kind of thing. But yeah, no, I think it's good at all counts. I've played it at all counts. I just really enjoyed it two players. I think it's a little bit more of a quick puzzle and can be that icebreaker game night for your date night or whatever it may be. Anna, this game currently is on Amazon for $41. At Miniature Market for $31, and MSRP is $45. Do you feel at the $31 price point that you are getting good value for this game?
Oh, absolutely. I would have pegged this as a $40 game. There's a lot of, I mean, again, the boards are beautiful. They're well organized. The dice sit down into their little pockets so they don't move around, mm-hmm. which is great when you get halfway through the game and somebody says, oh no, I have two fours next to, you know, they didn't accidentally knock it. It's been locked in the whole time. Yeah. And yeah, the boards and the dice and all the components, I would definitely put this at a $40 worth game.
I completely agree. The player boards alone for me are what really does it to where I'm like, okay, I have no problem paying $40 for this game. I do tend to lean towards the quality of the components when I'm looking at price point more than I do the game itself. But in this case, I think you're getting a great deal on both. And I, like I said earlier, I think that the higher quality components is almost necessary for the kind of puzzle that you're building. The dice are nice. They have a good feel to them. They're not too big. To where if you do have nine in a four-player game, you can roll all of them. But if it's, they're not too small. And so if you're only rolling five, you still feel like you're getting to chuck some dice and it's a good time. So with that, Anna, let's move into our grading and final thoughts.
I wanted to say one more thing because we talked about using it as a family game so much. Can you tell people, I was trying to look, but I couldn't see, what's the age recommendation for this game?
So the box says 13 plus.
Oh, interesting. I would have guessed more like 9 or 10.
If you go based off of BGG, which I tend to trust more, the community would say that 8 plus is the recommended age range for this, which I think I agree with. I think there's enough thinking and problem solving and planning ahead that much younger than that would really struggle with it. We haven't tried this with Faith yet. I think she could do it, but I also think
she'd be close.
You would want to give her the easiest option. And yes, she would definitely miss some stuff, which is okay. I mean, I think she's close to being able to do this one. And again, it's quick, so you're not going to really lose the attention unless it's a really short attention span, which is fine too.
Yeah. But I'm thinking about like a parent playing one-on-one with their 10, 11-year-old. That could be really fun. I think they would be right in there with you. The game would go quick still.
Absolutely.
I think it'd be a really fun thing to break out with your kids.
For sure. Absolutely. No, I completely agree with that.
All right. Now you can go on to grading and final thoughts.
All right. Now we'll do grading and final thoughts. Anna, I will go first because I think you will rate this higher than me.
What? You're not going to rate this highly?
I didn't say that.
What is wrong with you?
Hold on. I didn't say that.
This is art.
Can't you appreciate art?
No. You just said you weren't an artist earlier.
I'm not. I mean, no, I appreciate other people's artwork. I really do appreciate that. No, I'm going to give this game a solid 7.5.
What?
I think it's really good. I think it does exactly, as we have said so many times on this podcast, Sagrada does exactly what it wants to do. In that it is light enough to get lots of people to the table or a nice two-player interaction. It does a great job of that. It does a great job of being thinky, but at the same time, accessible. And so I really enjoy that. I also really enjoy the components, which adds to it in this particular case because it affects gameplay. For me, I don't know that I need to play it all the time. It's not one that I look on the shelf and I'm like, I have to get Sagrada back to the table. I really enjoy it when it comes out. It's almost like a forgotten favorite. And so that, for me, docks it a little bit. But I think 7.5 is really how I feel about it, in that I will always have a good time with it, but I'll never really label it as like any one of my favorite games.
Well, there you go.
You look so heartbroken.
That's what Jared thinks about art. No, see, I'm going to put it at like a 9 because...
I'm not surprised.
Well... And I wouldn't even say it's in my top 5 favorite games or anything, but that's because I tend to like more, like a little bit longer, a little bit deeper games.
Yeah.
But you can't judge a game in this category against a game like Terraforming Mars is one of my favorite games and I love it.
Yeah.
And they're just different categories. And so I think in its category, I can't think of anything it could do better. I mean, like my one thing was like, the colors are too close to each other, you know, which just shows, you know, that I'm not a real artist, apparently.
Dang, dreams broken.
Dreams, they were already broken, ripped to shreds in the locker room. But I think really just the fact that I can't think of hardly anything it could do better, and the fact that I would be down to play this game at any point in time. Whereas these other games, there's other games that I really like that I would get in or out of the mood for. I'd say, oh, I'm not really in the mood for that one. I think I would, if anybody suggested Sagrada, I would always be down because it just does what it does very, very well. So there you go. 9 is my final answer.
Nice. I think I'd bump it to an 8.25 if we exclusively played this at 2. I think the downtime is part of what, so you mentioned, because you mentioning being in the mood for a game and that kind of sparked this thought. I think part of it is I don't enjoy the downtime that comes with the simplicity of this game, because sometimes, and I'm sometimes the one that is guilty of this, there are times where you can really just put your head in your hands and look at your board over and over again, trying to make this thing fit, and it slows it down for everybody else at the table.
I mean, you did that with 2 players, but luckily we didn't have 3 other people
that were also doing that. And still got it done in under half an hour.
It's
so
true.
I'm just saying, like, that's why I think at 2 player, it does get bumped up a little bit for me. But I also do have that feeling of, do I really want to bring that out or do I want to play something else? So with that in mind, because I thought about this too in our exploration of podcasting and all that, what letter grade would you give this? Because we typically do letter grades on our 2-top instead of a 10-point scale.
I was wondering when you started doing a out of 10 thing.
I know.
I got really confused.
Leave it to the guy who runs things to screw everything up.
I was about to give it 2 thumbs up or whatever.
No, that's the kids one.
Oh, man. Okay.
We do letter grades. For some reason, we had to be different.
I mean, I'd give it an A because
okay.
I, if if anybody suggested it, I would probably play it. Again, I wouldn't be pulling it out every single week myself because it's slightly lighter than I like. I also really like, I think that every single time we've played this game with more than two people, we've had a brand new person involved.
That's true.
That has gotten right in. You can explain the rules to this game so fast.
Yes,
and just jump right in and start the game. Which you already talked about. Yeah, it's got that easy entry point. But yeah, I think it does what it does excellently, and I wouldn't really change hardly anything.
Sweet. I think it's a solid B. I'm not ashamed of that grade. So
there you go. All right.
Well, whether you're struggling to get a B in class because you're listening to this podcast instead of listening to your teacher, or if you're building some piece of artwork out on the street, I appreciate you. I've been told artists don't make any money, so I don't know.
Oh my goodness, that's so mean.
You know, but what's not mean is the fact that we really appreciate that you have listened to our episode.
Yeah. We just did that zinger right at you, come and subscribe.
If you have feedback on the quality of my quippy comments or on the episode as a whole or the game, we would love to hear from you. Links to our socials are in the description. If you don't like socials, I totally get it. Shoot us an email at thegametablepodcast@gmail.com or find us on BoardGameGeek. 5-star reviews, subscribing in your podcast player of choice, following us on socials, if that's your thing, and joining the conversation on Discord. All of these heroic actions are immensely helpful in growing this podcast. Special thanks to Angie Santiago for our cover art and to Anna Snyder who made the music. Join us next week as Ian and I take a look at Let's Go to Japan. In the meantime, may your dice rolls and your card draws be blessed, and your experiences at the table be ones to remember forever.
See you later. Enjoy doing your sidewalk chalk art outside.
Dang.
There's some gorgeous sidewalk chalk.
That's true. So, that is very true.
Yep. Just trying to think of things that you could do on the street.
I regret everything.